Another age group to consider is older lovers, perhaps from the age of 50 to the so-called golden years celebrated in the film On Golden Pond. The underlying drive toward procreation is at rest. Companionship increases in importance. Shared experience in the past becomes a vital part of the present. Security, both economic and emotional, becomes more important. And there is the omnipresent fear or acceptance of inevitable death. But one should consider certain liabilities of this fertile ground for the writer. In Western countries, sadly, there is far less respect for the wisdom that comes with age than in Eastern countries. As a result, among the young, there is little interest in the aged. When love relationships among older persons are handled expertly, the results are felt by audiences of all ages, but the marketing of such material is encumbered with difficulty. As the population in developed countries lives longer, however, there may be a shift in interest that will make love stories involving older characters easier to market. Questions to ask yourself if you are considering a story with older lovers. In developing your love scene, is there a hovering notion that the lovers do not have all the time in the world? Have you included the need for companionship, often the most urgent need of older people? Have you included touching or some other physical relationship that will enhance the poignancy? The key to writing an effective love scene is to imagine it from the perspective of each of the partners. If the writer is a woman, she should give special thought to the perspective of the man in the scene. If the writer is a man, he should give special thought to the perspective of the woman. Then the scene can be written from the third-person point of view, or from the first-person point of view of either of the characters, but the writer will have imagined the thoughts and feelings of both partners, which should enable the scene to be written as richly as possible. A scene can also be enriched if either of the participants gains an insight about the other person. What are some of the things a writer can do to enhance a love scene? You can place an object in the room that is meaningful to one or both lovers. If possible, plant the object before the love scene. Don't let either of the lovers notice it until an important juncture in that scene, when one of them sees the object, turns off, and the other lover has to rekindle the relationship. This is really a modified version of what happens in most stories, with obstacles in the way of the protagonist getting what he wants. Another obstacle can be the weather. If the lovers are preparing for an outing in the countryside, a sudden storm will interfere with their plans. They seek refuge in what looks like an unoccupied building, but is it unoccupied? Or will a sudden snowstorm keep illicit lovers housebound in a house to which the spouse of one of them will be returning soon? These suggestions, and those that follow, are not meant to be specific plot points for you to pursue. They are examples of the kinds of obstacle one might use to prolong a love scene that can become a love sequence. A tack you might consider is to have something unexpected happen that causes a misunderstanding. The more one of the lovers tries to clear up the misunderstanding, the deeper it gets. Make it seem that the impasse is unsurmountable. Then introduce a third character who can make the impasse worse, or who can provide a way of clearing up the misunderstanding. Another tack would be to have the third character not know that the two are lovers, and the lovers have a reason for not wanting the third character to find out about their relationship. That involves unrehearsed play-acting by the lovers, ripe for mischief. Conversely, a couple can pretend they are together when, in fact, they are not. Then, if a third character were to say or do something that makes it absolutely necessary for both the lovers to continue the pretense, you have an interesting development. The moment the third character leaves is a moment of high tension. Will the couple drop their pretense, or will the pretense have started something they didn't expect? The intrusion in a love scene doesn't have to be from a third person related to either or both parties. It doesn't even need to be a person that is intruding. We've just discussed the weather intruding. An earthquake, a firestorm, or any other catastrophe can be a mighty intrusion, provided it is handled realistically rather than as melodrama. But note this. Though an action is the ideal interruption, a thought can also interrupt, particularly a significant thought or memory, and it can be a lot more effective than the local volcano blowing its top. A love scene and a sex scene are not the same. A poignant love scene can be written with the lovers not coming close enough to touch. As an instance, consider the prisoner unjustly tried and accused, who has to communicate with his beloved on visitor's day through a glass shield, speaking on phones, though they are only inches apart physically. Conversely, a sex scene need have nothing to do with love, as in a scene of casual sex between strangers or a rape. If it is your plan to make your love scene erotic, a few points are worth considering. As I noted earlier, the most important erogenous zone is the head, which means that if a man's head isn't turned on, he won't be able to function. If a woman's head isn't turned on, her failure to experience may lead to faking. The rabbit approach to sex has little to do with the relations between the sexes that can be experienced by readers. The same is true for mechanical recitations of sexual play without regard to what is happening to the emotions of the people involved. Many years ago, I met Maurice Girodiat, the French publisher who became notorious as the publisher of sexually explicit novels in English. Those green-covered paperbacks infiltrated into America in the luggage of tourists long before the liberation of sexuality in literature in the late 50s and early 60s. Quite a few of Girodiat's pseudonymous authors later made their reputations under their real names. Girodiat was a master at teaching his authors how to handle erotic material. One Girodiat-sponsored title had what I remember as the ultimate seduction scene. It held the reader for about 100 pages before the relationship was consummated. This is not something to strive to imitate. It demonstrates a principle. The point to grasp is that the mere description of multiple sex acts does little or nothing for the reader. A single act kept at bay, warmed to, stretched out, can have a marked erotic effect. In preparing to write an erotic scene, the writer has to be clear about the relationship between the couple and has to know what he is trying to accomplish in his story through the sexual intimacy. The most common possibilities include an assignation, colloquially a quickie. Though it has nothing to do with love, this kind of scene can be erotic. But even a so-called quickie can't be quick on the page and have an effect on the reader. It must move the story forward by having an effect on one or the other character. Even a meaningless assignation has to have a meaning for at least one of the characters, or it doesn't belong in the story. More common in fiction is the one-night stand. A brief, not-to-be-repeated encounter has greater potential for a story than a meaningless copulation, but to have an important effect on the reader, it, too, has to convey something about each character. Why is each of the participants doing this, and how does each of them react to the experience while it's happening and afterward? More interesting is the sexual encounter that is the budding of a love affair. Because it is a beginning, the scene can be full of nuances, problems, thoughts, actions. Think of it as a back-and-forth experience and not a straight line. Each digression, if it doesn't take the reader away from the fundamental goal of the scene, can heighten and extend the experience. My novel, Other People, contains a number of scenes between George Thomasy, a 44-year-old lawyer, and Francine Widmer, a 27-year-old client who becomes his lover. The scene I will refer to runs about 6 pages. It's not about continuous lovemaking. Other things happen. The interruptions, planned by the author, stretch the tension between the beginning and its consummation, but the interruptions are all part of the story. Thomasy and Francine were brought together as a result of Francine being raped. Her father, a corporate lawyer, persuaded Thomasy, a criminal lawyer, to help his daughter, who was seeking to get the rapist put in jail. Francine had not had sex since the rape until the scene I am about to describe. An important choice was to write the scene from the woman's point of view. The scene starts with a detailed description of a meal that Thomasy is preparing for both himself and Francine in his home. The fact that she is in his house in itself sets the stage for the possibility of an erotic scene. That possibility hangs in the air, as it were, over the scene that follows, when they talk and think about other things. Note that what they talk about is specific, for instance, a painting that is prominent on Thomasy's wall. From a few words about the artist, Francine's thoughts wander to the idea that good art lingers into posterity, while the work of most people in the professions is forgotten, except perhaps for the rare work of an innovating genius. Francine is surprised that artists aren't hated more by those whose work is by its nature transient. Thomasy, a successful criminal lawyer, responds, "I'm a salesman. I sell cases to juries or to punk DAs." When Thomasy puts himself down, he is actually raising himself in the reader's eyes. The reader knows how tough and successful he is as a lawyer. The reader's emotional reaction to Thomasy's self-description is something like, "Hey, Thomasy, don't knock yourself. I've seen what you can do." This technique of elevating by seeming to do its opposite sets Thomasy up as a potentially interesting lover because he has insight into himself, and that usually means insight into others. In the scene, the conversation momentarily turns back to the dinner they are finishing. As to sex, nothing is happening, except in the reader's head. In fact, by this time, the reader is liking them as a couple and wants one of them to make a move. The author is not quite ready to oblige. Thomasy snaps on the TV set for the 10 o'clock news, which tells us the evening is getting late. Francine runs water to do the dishes. Thomasy says he'll do them and comes up behind her at the sink. The entire scene is from her point of view. The front of his body was touching the back of mine. I felt his lips on the lobe of my right ear just for a second. "It's all right," I said. "A woman doesn't want to be admired just for her mind." He put his arms around me and took the dish I was rinsing carefully out of my hands and put it aside. "I'll do those later," he said. "I should be going soon." He turned me toward him. "My hands are wet," I said. He took my head in both his hands and touched his lips to mine, a skim for a split second. I kept my wet hands wide apart as he kissed me again, this time mouth to mouth. I broke away. "My hands are wet," I said, breathless. "I don't care." And then I put my wet hands around him as our mouths met. I could feel his body's warmth and my own heart pound, and suddenly he was kissing the side of my neck, then below and behind my ear. I could feel his tongue flicker, and then our mouths were together again until, to breathe, I pulled away, feeling the blood in my face. And I was quickly drying my hands on the dish towel when he pulled me into his arms again, and I knew we both knew it was no use fighting it anymore, and we were holding each other tightly and desperately, and then we were moving each other to the couch, not wanting to let go, but we had to open the couch, and then it was kissing again and clothes coming off, his and mine, and we were lying, clasped, kissing lips, faces, shoulders, then holding on, sealed against each other, until he raised his head and realized there were tears in my eyes, and his bewildered look was begging for an explanation. I could hear the thud of my heart. "What's the matter?" he whispered. I couldn't find my voice. "Tell me," he said. It was like the anxiety attacks I would get in the middle of the night when insomnia stole my sleeping hours, a fear that my heart would burst from the thudding. "It's like driving the first time after an accident," I said. We lay side by side for a while. At this point, Francine lies there thinking about an incident in high school. The reader is feeling, "Get on with it." Then he got up, naked and unashamed, and went somewhere, returning with two elegant glasses filled halfway with something I didn't recognize. "Madeira," he said. "Rainwater." He took a sip. "Magic," he said, and handed me my glass. "It's a one-drink drink. Safe." I looked at the glass skeptically. "It's okay," he said. "Try it." I took a sip. "Lovely," I said, licking it from my lips. "Don't do that," he said. "What?" I took another sip. He leaned over and licked my lower lip. No one had ever done that. He slid onto the bed, holding his glass upright as if it were a gyroscope. Then he tipped it slightly and let a few drops splash onto my breast. "Don't move," he said, and gave me his glass to hold. There I was, helplessly holding one glass in each hand, unable to move, and he licked the Madeira from each breast and from the valley between. He borrowed his glass back, tipped it lower down, then handed it back, my handcuff. I looked at the two glasses, at the ceiling, then at the soft hair of his head as he licked the drops of Madeira. I'll stop the scene a couple of pages before the end, because I'm certain that by this time you will see how I've stretched the scene, concerned with the readers wanting Thomasy and Francine to get together, and knowing that my job was to keep them apart. The scene is a literary form of foreplay. Note that the scene consists of many short sentences. Then the paragraph in which they move to the couch is long, almost all of it one extended sentence. The tension of arousal is handled with snippets. The breakthrough is written as breathless continuum. At that point, the specter of Francine's rape arises. The sex is stalled, but not the scene. Thomasy brings her a special drink to intoxicate her, not with alcohol, but with what he proceeds to do with the drink. The sex act itself is handled the same way. This is a love story, and their first sexual encounter is related to the things that bring them together. We experience love blooming, not just passing fornication. Lovemaking between a couple that has made love before can be a more difficult task for the writer. Art imitates life. If the likely outcome is known to the participants, it removes an element of suspense. For the experienced writer, it may mean creating a delay, or even an event or action that stops the inevitable. A scene between lovers experienced with each other can be helped by a surprise, the opposite of the expected, or an intrusion. In writing a particular scene in The Magician, my design was to portray the 16-year-old villain Urich's vulnerability, to create a touch of sympathy for him, and at the same time to give the reader some clues as to the possible origins of his violent nature. His involvement is with a girl called the Kraut, who has been having sex with Urich's gang, usually serially in full view of the others. This time Urich, in trouble, has come to the Kraut's home by himself. The Kraut is surprised when Urich shows up at her place. Urich has committed a crime that has excited him, but he is not an articulate boy and tries to shrug off her questions. She says, "What are you so worked up about?" And he exclaims, "Jesus, I gotta talk to somebody." She puts him down by saying, "How about your mother?" Finally, she agrees to listen to him and locks the door of her room. She sits down at her vanity mirror and starts combing her hair. You may recall that in the chapter on characterization, I referred to the supposition of some psychologists that a woman's hair conveys a strong sexual force. Most men find it disquieting or repulsive to imagine a woman bald or losing her hair. Recall that after World War II, when the French wanted to dehumanize women who collaborated by having sex with the enemy, they shaved their heads. Urich wants the Kraut to turn around to face him. She says she can't comb her hair if she turns around. That's when he touches her hair. She is sarcastic. "Well, you're getting real romantic." She doesn't expect romance from him. The author provides a delaying action. The Kraut asks Urich if he's ever talked to a priest, and Urich rants about why that doesn't work for him in a way that draws a touch of sympathy from her. She says, "Come here." In that context, those two words start the erotic engine. She, still sitting, puts her hands around Urich's waist, then lays her cheek against him and listens to his heartbeat. "Hey, you're alive," she said, letting her hand drop and just brush the front of his pants. "What do you do that for?" She laughed. "Say," he said, "are you really a nympho? Some of the guys say..." He thought she was going to make him get out. Instead, she said, "Your mother and father... they don't like it when they do it, do they?" "I never thought about it." "You had to. Everybody does. You think any of the old people like to do it?" "How would I know?" "You ever watch them?" "What do you think I am?" "I do. I got away. It's what gave me the idea before." "Before what?" "Before I ever did anything with anybody." Urich wants her to stop talking. She goes on talking, but unhooks her bra and says, "You never once kissed me." He says, You mean on them?
On the mouth, stupid.
We learn that Eric has never kissed any girl on the mouth. She teaches him. His head was in a roar. He could feel the needling in his groin, the signal, but couldn't connect the idea of kissing lips and a feeling half his body away.
Do it to me, she said. He looked blank. What I'm doing to you.
Their mouths met, and despite the slaver and terrified thoughts in his head, he felt himself stiffening with an urgency, the need to rush. She slipped off her shoes, unwrapped her skirt, let it drop, and stepped out of it. She took her half-slip off.
You don't have to take everything off, said Eric.
She took her socks off, and then stepped out of her white panties. The hair where her legs met was dark, not blonde, like her long hair.
Aren't you going to turn the light off? He said.
She shrugged her shoulders and turned the switch. It merely dimmed the light, one of those three-way bulbs now at its lowest setting. Then, completely naked, she sat down in front of her dressing table again and again combed her hair. He could have killed her.
You afraid of catching cold? She said, turning. Take your clothes off.
He got down to his shorts and socks, then stood adamant.
Take your socks off.
He took off first one, then the other.
The rest, too, she said. Want some help?
He wasn't going to have any girl undressing him. He let his shorts drop to the floor, the hairiness of his body now wholly exposed to her view.
Well,
she said at his preparedness. He gestured toward the bed.
What's your hurry?
She came closer to him, and he gestured toward the bed again. Her hands were on him, stroking, and he tried now with force at her shoulders to push her to the bed, but it was suddenly too late, and like an idiot he stood there, coming in spasms. The crowd was frightened at his anger. He didn't say anything. She put her arms around him, it seemed to him tenderly, and sat him down at the edge of the bed. She kissed the side of his neck, then his cheek, and then his closed mouth. He motioned for her to turn the light completely off, which she did, so that she wouldn't see him. But when he lay down, his face in the pillow, she could hear him smothering the shame of his sobs. In some ways, that scene is akin to the classic scene of a boy being initiated by a prostitute. However, this boy has had sex with this girl before in the company of his cronies. This time, a special circumstance has arisen. He has come to her after trying to kill the protagonist. The intent of the scene is to enlarge the characterization of both Eric and the girl by showing his vulnerability as well as his anger. Though the girl disdains him, when he fails, she shows compassion. Note how the action in the scene is delayed time and again. For the reader, this continues the tension. In writing any sexual episode, you have to guard against fashioning a scene of continuous lovemaking. It needs to be broken up by thoughts, actions, digressions, delays that are pertinent to the story. Toward that end, you may find it useful to make a list of each character's concerns during the scene. To maximize tension, those concerns should be different. Keep the actor's studio technique in mind by giving each of your characters a different script for their love scene. When you revise, test each part of the scene for what you believe the reader is feeling at that moment. You need to remind yourself until it becomes second nature that you are playing the emotions of an audience. In writing love scenes, you need to let the reader's imagination do a lot of the work. I want to conclude with a caution. The violence that accompanies sex in some novels, film, and TV is not only offensive in principle, but also counterproductive. Small actions or a few well-chosen words can move the reader much more than an act of violence. While you are learning to master love scenes, I urge you to find subtleties that will enable readers to fill the envelope you have created, which is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 19, Creating the Envelope. This chapter is short, which is only appropriate to its point. Less is more. Writing fiction is a delicate balance. On the one hand, so much inexperienced writing suffers from generalities. The writer is urged to be specific, particular, concrete. At the same time, when the inexperienced writer gives the reader detail on character, clothing, settings, and actions, he tends to give us a surfeit, robbing the reader of one of the great pleasures of reading, exercising the imagination. My advice on achieving a balance is to choose the most effective detail and to err on the side of too little rather than too much. For the reader's imagination, less is more. You can't have come this far without knowing that my most urgent message to writers is that you are providing stimuli for the reader's experience. I remember Shelley Lohenkopf, a remarkable teacher of writers, admonishing the author of what was intended as a love scene that her mention of every article of clothing that was being removed read like a laundry list rather than a scene between two people. A more common error is detailing the clothing worn by a character as if preparing a missing persons bulletin, when one distinguishing item would suffice and allow the reader to imagine the rest. Examine the following sentence from Nancy Kincaid's novel Crossing Blood, a trove of good writing. In this scene, children are playing in the yard. Their old grandmother looks out the window all the time, her face pressed against the glass. Does the author tell us what the grandmother is thinking or seeing? Not a bit. The reader, given the context, can imagine whatever he likes that fits the story. The more the reader's imagination can be substituted for detail from the writer, the greater the reader's experience will be. The mistake we make frequently is telling the reader what the old grandmother is seeing. The point is, that's where the grandmother is spending her time, at the window, looking. You can give the reader's imagination room with a few common words in context. Most grandmothers prattled on about their grandchildren, but when Bettina was asked about hers, she would pause as if reflecting on each of them in turn, and then state for the record, "They are fine." I have sometimes described the reader's experience to students as an envelope. It is a mistake to fill the envelope with so much detail that little or nothing is left to the reader's imagination. The writer's job is to fill the envelope with just enough to trigger the reader's imagination. For a nonfiction example, let's look at George Orwell's first paragraph in The Road to Wigan Pier. The first sound in the mornings was the clumping of the mill girls' clogs down the cobbled street. Earlier than that, I suppose, there were factory whistles which I was never awake to hear. There were generally four of us in the bedroom. Orwell creates an envelope for an industrial town in two sentences, the sound of clogs on the cobbled street and the factory whistles he didn't hear. The reader's imagination fills in the rest. That taken care of, Orwell immediately takes the reader inside one of the houses. Let's look at some examples of the use of an envelope in contemporary fiction. First, the beginning of Canadian author Michael Ondaatje's Booker Prize-winning novel, The English Patient. She stands up in the garden where she has been working and looks into the distance. She has sensed a shift in the weather. There is another gust of wind, a buckle of noise in the air, and the tall cypresses sway. She turns and moves uphill towards the house, climbing over a low wall, feeling the first drops of rain on her bare arms. She crosses the loggia and quickly enters the house. The woman, nameless, is looking into the distance. The reader, who is not told what she is looking at, has to imagine what she might be seeing. Her first impression that it might rain comes from a sixth sense, then wind, noise, and finally raindrops. The author supplies only a minimum amount of information. Inside, the nameless woman enters a room. The man lies on the bed, his body exposed to the breeze, and he turns his head slowly toward her as she enters. We don't know who the man is, but we find out quickly that he is badly burned. How did he get burned? We learn she has been nursing him for months. Who is she? Ondaatje's writing is full of particularities that the reader can see and at the same time allows ample room for the play of the reader's imagination.
The grand master of giving the reader's imagination room to play is Franz Kafka. Here's how The Trial begins. Someone must have been telling lies about Joseph K., for without having done anything wrong, he was arrested one fine morning. His landlady's cook, who always brought him his breakfast at 8 o'clock, failed to appear on this occasion. That had never happened before. K. waited for a little while longer, watching from his pillow the old lady opposite, who seemed to be peering at him with a curiosity unusual even for her, but then, feeling both put out and hungry, he rang the bell. At once there was a knock at the door, and a man entered whom he had never seen before in the house. Even at the beginning of the first paragraph, we begin to feel Joseph K.'s anxiety. As you read The Trial, there is no let-up. The reader's anxiety converge on terror, not the make-believe kind, but a terror that the reader associates with things in his own experience. Kafka, master of the envelope, creates the atmosphere of a nightmare that seems real, in which his character is beset by the impersonal forces of authority, the police, and the bureaucracy that will not tell him what he is guilty of. Less is more when it comes to stimulating strong emotions in the reader. One of the mistakes made by some of the popular thriller writers is that they describe the terror of characters instead of letting the reader feel the terror as Kafka does. I have been visited a number of times by Joe Vitarelli, a successful motion picture actor who was writing his first novel. The little I've read of it shows a remarkable talent. Some of the things he learned about writing may have come from instruction he received from his father. When he was young, Vitarelli's father said to him, "Nobody can terrorize you as effectively as you can terrorize yourself." Vitarelli had a character saying, "You have two choices. I can kill you, or something else can happen. Why don't you wait and see?" End of chapter. The envelope is made. The reader can terrorize himself by waiting, or he can go on reading. Part 3. Fiction and Nonfiction. Chapter 20. Amphetamines for Speeding Up Pace. The success of a book is measured by the satisfaction of readers. The measure of a reading experience is often expressed as, "This really moves fast," or "This book is slow going." Each describes the pace or tempo of a book in which fast is good and slow is bad. I've heard editors, authors, and readers describe books as a cannonball or a zipper, assuming speed to be a virtue. Yet the best of good books have purposeful slowdowns in pace from time to time, because the authors know that readers, like athletes, must catch their breath. Why then the obsession with pace? Because a laggardly pace is characteristic of a majority of novels that get turned down by publishers, and, alas, of some that find their way into print but not into the hearts and recommendations of readers. Most rejected manuscripts move too slowly, encouraging their readers to put them down. I was tempted to call this chapter "Teaching the Unteachable," because of an event that happened many years ago. 5 editors from New York publishing houses, myself among them, were on a panel at a meeting of the American Society of Authors and Journalists. Amid the many faces staring up at us were quite a few belonging to professional nonfiction writers who wanted to try their hands at fiction. When one questioned the panel about pace, my 4 colleagues suggested in turn that pace was a matter of ear or instinct, and hence unteachable. I answered last and said in as inoffensive a tone as I could muster, "Here's how it's done." There was an immediate rustle of writers reaching into their briefcases for pen and paper. There are quite a few techniques for stepping up the pace of fiction, ranging from the simple to the quite complex. Most of these techniques are adaptable for nonfiction also. Journalists know that short sentences step up pace. They also know that frequent paragraphing accelerates the pace. Short sentences plus frequent paragraphing step up pace even more. Those are simple observations that come to fiction writers only belatedly, and when nonfiction writers turn to fiction, they often forget these simple rules. In fiction, a quick exchange of adversarial dialogue often proves to be an ideal way of picking up pace by the use of short sentences and paragraphing. Here's an example. Ben Riller, Broadway play producer, has been ducking phone calls from a reporter named Robertson. When Robertson calls again, Riller decides to take the call. Note how the brief exchange starts with a relaxed paragraph and how the pace picks up as the sentences get clipped. Also note that there are 12 paragraphs in this brief conversation.
Hi, Mr. Riller. I've been trying to reach you about a little item we're running in tomorrow's paper about the show. I'd just like to get your comment to the story around town that the best revenge may never open.
Mr. Robertson?
Yes?
If I tell you you're wrong, your story will say producer denies show folding, right?
Unless you'd care to confirm that it is folding or make some other comment.
I do, I said.
Slowly, please, he said, so I can take it down.
Mr. Robertson, I said,
does your wife have syphilis?
Robertson's voice shrilled.
What the hell kind of question is that?
I'll tell you, I said. I've got an AP Wire Service reporter here finishing up an interview, and he'd like to run a story saying, Post reporter denies wife has syphilis.
Well, has she or hasn't she?
I could hear Robertson breathing. Then he said, You win, Mr. Riller, and hung up.
It isn't necessary to use dialogue to pick up the pace. Short sentences and frequent paragraphing alone can do the job. Here's a rather extreme example. The alley was dark. I could see a rectangle of light at the other end. I had no choice. Jode was gaining. The clop-clop of my shoes echoed as I ran. Damn these high heels. Suddenly, a figure filled the rectangle of light up ahead. Was it Leech? Or a cop? I stopped. The silence was awful. Over my shoulder, I saw Jode enter the alley, boxing me in. There were no doors. I couldn't climb the brick walls. I dug in my purse for the police whistle. A deep breath, I told myself. The whistle was ice cold against my lips. I blew again and again till my ears hurt. Jode's laugh echoed down the alley. The figure at the other end laughed, too.
Note that in addition to stepping up the pace, the clipped sentences and frequent paragraphing increase the tension. Skipping steps can also increase the reader's sense of pace. The following example provides information in what might be described as a normal pace. In the morning he would shower, brush his teeth, shave, dress in a suitable business suit with shirt and tie, get down to the kitchen in time to have his coffee, and then rush off to the station. But he'd frequently miss his train anyway. Here's how my friend and neighbor John Cheever did it in his celebrated story, The Country Husband. He washed his body, shaved his jaws, drank his coffee, and missed the 7:31. Eliminating about two-thirds of the words steps up the pace brilliantly. I call this skipping for effect. A technique for stepping up pace in fiction that isn't used enough is flipping forward past a scene that never appears in the book. Not too many decades ago, when a door closed on a couple getting into bed, the chapter would end. When the next chapter started, the coupling was long gone. The bedroom scene existed only in the reader's imagination. The effect on the reader was that of the pace quickening. Here's how the same effect can be achieved in today's less prudish environment. In my novel, The Magician, there is one scene in which four rough teenagers meet with an older girl for beer and sex. That chapter ends with the girl saying, "Okay, who's first?" The next chapter goes to a different location with other characters. The scene that the reader anticipates never happens. I was not being prudish. I did it to step up the pace. Though the book had several million readers, none ever complained about the missing scene. The point, of course, is that the more that happens in the reader's imagination, the greater his appreciation of your story. This applies to any kind of scene. There's an extra benefit to picking up pace by skipping a scene. In revising your manuscript, you may find some scene that doesn't work as well as you had hoped. Consider skipping that scene and turning a liability into an asset if removing the scene propels the pace of your story. In the chapter on suspense, I showed how suspense can be prolonged throughout an entire book by following each cliffhanging chapter ending with a chapter that moves to a different location or has different characters. While that technique of scene switching is designed primarily to sustain more than one line of suspense throughout, it also has the effect of increasing the pace of a story. I mentioned earlier a technique widely used in film called jump cutting. It works just as well in novels as it does in movies. With this technique, a story moves from one scene to the next without the in-between matter that would be part of getting from one place to the next. In life, you might leave your apartment, go down the stairs and out into the street, get into your car, drive to your destination, and enter a restaurant. Showing all of that in a movie, or including it in fiction, would be a drag and boring. In jump cutting, the viewer of a film might see a character close the door of a house and immediately appear in a restaurant, perhaps even at a table in the middle of a meal. Viewers have no trouble with jump cutting. And it makes the film seem to move fast. In a novel, a character might close a door. This would be followed by a line space. The next scene is in a restaurant. Jump cutting is also available to the nonfiction writer. Skipping in between matter increases the reader's sense of an agreeable pace and keeps him turning the pages. There are three more techniques for stepping up pace that are inherent in the process of deleting the flab in a manuscript. That is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 21. Liposuctioning Flab. It was a reviewer for Publishers Weekly named Jeffrey Zaleski who first suggested in print that a forthcoming book needed liposuctioning. It's a perfect description of an important part of the editorial process. Flab is not only the enemy of anyone with excessive flesh, it is the enemy of every writer. Superfluous words and phrases soften prose. Fortunately, there is an antidote. Flab cutting is one of the best means for improving the pace of both fiction and nonfiction. When eliminated, the loss of fat has the welcome side effect of strengthening the body of remaining text. Flab, if not removed, can have a deleterious effect on the impatient reader, who will pay less attention to each word and begin to skip. Skimming, trying to pick out the best parts of text while reading, is as unsatisfactory as trying to pick out the seeds of raspberry jam. The quickest way of increasing the pace of a manuscript and strengthening it at the same time is to remove all adjectives and adverbs and then readmit the necessary few after careful testing. One of the students in my seminar who had an adjective habit found that after eliminating all unnecessary adjectives and adverbs from his book-length manuscript, it was 73 pages shorter and considerably stronger. Mark Twain said, "If you catch an adjective, kill it." Take his incitement to murder as a measure of his conviction. The depth of his feelings about adjectives is understandable. He was attempting to pierce the resistance of writers. Most writers erect a great wall against the process of eliminating all but a minimal number of adjectives and adverbs. I will guide you through the process of examining them, knowing that Twain is dragging you by one arm as I am by the other. Most adjectives and adverbs are dispensable. The easiest ones to dispense with are very and quite. Word processing programs make the process simple. Find and delete all the verys and quites that crept into your first draft. Waste adjectives are entirely unneeded. Here's an example of a waste adjective that needs dumping. The conspicuous bulge in his jacket had to be a weapon. You don't need the word conspicuous. The sentence is stronger without it. Adjective surgery can be painful unless you practice it rigorously and examine the results. Let's try some less painful preoperative procedures first. Go through your text and find any place where you have used two adjectives with a single noun, such as, "He was a feisty, combative reporter." Eliminate one of the adjectives. Keep the stronger one. In the example, I'd keep feisty, since it's more evocative than combative. Experience proves that when two adjectives are used, eliminating either strengthens the text. The more concrete adjective is the one to keep, or the one that makes the image more visual. Let's think together about the following sentence. He was a strong, resourceful warrior. If we delete resourceful, we have a strong warrior. If we delete strong, we have a resourceful warrior. Each would give us a different meaning. A strong warrior is commonplace. A resourceful warrior might be a more interesting choice, but the meaning we are striving for would dictate our choice. The point is that the elimination of either adjective would lend strength to the sentence, and in context, the cut would help improve the pace. Quite apart from eliminating one out of six words, the comma goes too, and commas tend to slow the reading process. Here's another example of the use of two adjectives with a noun. He was a very strong, very powerful tennis player. The first step, of course, is to take out those verys. What's left is, he was a strong, powerful tennis player. Still too much. Which adjective do you eliminate to strengthen the text? You have a choice. He was a strong tennis player. He was a powerful tennis player. Each is better than the original. Powerful has a special meaning in tennis, someone who hits the ball hard and has a hard serve. A strong tennis player would be one who plays well tactically and delivers excellent strokes. Few players are both. The choice should not be arbitrary. In addition to eliminating unnecessary words, I am focusing on using words for their precise meaning, which is the mark of a good writer. Here's a more difficult choice. What would you remove from the following sentence? As he walked away, he seemed to be rocking, swaying from side to side like Charlie Chaplin. Your choices are several. You could remove rocking or swaying from side to side. In this case, whether you remove rocking or swaying, it might be advisable to keep from side to side because it is visual, even though it is implied by either rocking or swaying. In cutting excess verbiage, keep words that help the reader visualize the precise image you are trying to fashion. Here's a two-adjective sentence that needs improvement. What a lovely, colorful garden! Which of those two adjectives, lovely and colorful, would you eliminate? You would be better off with the elimination of either adjective. However, if you take out colorful and keep lovely, you would not be making the best choice, because lovely is vague and colorful is specific and therefore gives the reader a more concrete image to visualize. Examining your adjectives provides an opportunity to see if you could possibly invoke the reader's curiosity with an adjective that is better than either one you now have. What adjective could you use instead of both lovely and colorful? There are several curiosity-provoking adjectives you might have chosen. What a curious garden! What a strange garden! What an eerie garden! What a remarkable garden! What a bizarre garden! Lovely and colorful don't draw us in because we expect a garden to be lovely or colorful. If we hear that a garden is curious, strange, eerie, remarkable, or bizarre, we want to know why. An adjective that piques the reader's curiosity helps move a story along. Of course, it needn't be an adjective that provokes the reader's interest. For instance, consider. She'd never seen a garden quite like this one. Any word or group of words that makes the reader ask why or how also serves as an inducement for the reader to go on. Like any good rule, using one adjective in place of two has exceptions. Sometimes two adjectives or an adverb modifying the adjective are necessary to create a specific image. Meryl Streep stood the way a heavily pregnant woman will, in two motions, out of the chair and then up. Pregnant alone wouldn't give you the same image. There are several rules for determining which adjectives to keep. An adjective that is a necessity. Example, his right eye kept blinking. If you didn't keep right, it might sound as if you were talking about a one-eyed man. An adjective that stimulates the reader's curiosity and thereby helps move a story along. Example, he had a pursued look. Wouldn't work without the adjective. Moreover, the adjective raises curiosity about why he had that pursued look. An adjective that helps the reader visualize the precise image you want to project. The spoon left a line of froth on his sad mustache. Without sad, the line is merely descriptive. With sad, it characterizes both the person described and, by inference, the speaker. An adjective, of course, modifies a noun. An adverb modifies a verb. Most adverbs require the same tough surgery as adjectives. Leona wished he would call soon. The meaning of soon is implied. The adverb is unnecessary. The sentence is stronger without it. A frequent error is the use of two adverbs. Which of the two adverbs in the following sentence would you eliminate? She really, truly cared for him. Would you eliminate really or truly? You could take out either. She really cared for him is okay. She truly cared for him is okay too. But best of all is she cared for him. It is direct and picks up the pace. Small as these changes seem, cumulatively they have a powerful effect on prose. Using more than one adverb is a common fault. Here's an example from a current best-selling author. John got up quickly and walked restlessly to the window. He turned suddenly, smiling confidently. Then he sat down slowly, heavily. That makes six adverbs in two sentences. Watch what happens when you eliminate five of them. John got up and walked to the window. He turned suddenly, smiling. Then he sat down. The pace is improved not only by eliminating five adverbs, but also by shortening the sentences. Before you begin eliminating all adverbs by rote, keep in mind that sometimes adverbs can be helpful. There are two adverbs in the following short sentence. Each conveys something different. He ate heartily, happily. Heartily connotes eating a lot. Happily connotes taking pleasure. If it is the author's intention to convey both meanings, the adverbs should be retained. He ate without either adverb tells us little. I hurriedly scribbled the number down on the pad. Why get rid of hurriedly? Because scribbling connotes hurry. If not all adverbs should be cut, what is the purpose of this exercise? It is to get you to pay close attention to whether each word is helping or hurting your intention. Most of the time, two adverbs slow down the pace and weaken the sentence therein. But changes should not be made mechanically. I have two rules for testing adverbs to see if they are worth keeping. Keep an adverb that supplies necessary information. Example, he tried running faster and fell. If he's already running, you must keep faster. If you remove the adverb, the sentence means that he fell as soon as he started running. Keep an adverb that helps the reader visualize the precise image you want to project. Example, she drove crazily, frightening the oncoming traffic. Don't let these exceptions make you lose sight of the fact that most adverbs can be eliminated. Verbs can also get in the way of pace. Here's one example. He was huffing and puffing as he climbed the steep street. The one adjective in the sentence, steep, shouldn't be removed because if the street isn't steep, why the huffing and puffing? It's the huffing and puffing that spoils the sentence because that phrase is a cliché, a tired, overused, familiar conjunction of words. It would be perfectly acceptable to say, he was puffing as he climbed the steep street. Can you detect the flab in the following sentence? Two of the six words are unnecessary. This idea is an interesting one. Do you find the following sentence stronger? This idea is interesting. The flab words are an and one. Removing flab may seem a simple procedure, and in fact it is once a writer gets the habit of looking for the waste words as if he were an editor. Which words would you remove from the following sentence? There is nothing I would like better than to meet an interesting person who could become a new friend. Here's a clue. To quicken the pace, delete 10 of the 19 words. Don't go on until you've found all 10 words. Be as tough on yourself in eliminating unnecessary words as you think I might be if I were editing your manuscript. The best writers of the hundreds I've dealt with over the years were also the toughest on themselves. If you don't find all 10 dispensable words, try again until you do. I've bracketed the words that could be deleted. Bracket, there is nothing, end bracket. I would like, bracket, better than, end bracket, to meet an interesting, bracket, person who could become a, end bracket, new friend. More than half the words have been eliminated. Certain words frequently constitute flab and can be eliminated. However, almost, entire, successive, respective, perhaps, always, there is. Each writer can compile a list of his own, words he uses from time to time that contribute nothing but flab to a text. Your own made-to-order list will serve as the best guide. You've undoubtedly heard it said that the best writers make every word count. Not always. They, like us, sometimes slip up. Here's an example from Pete Dexter's excellent novel, Paris Trout, which won the 1988 National Book Award for Fiction. In the moment of illumination, though, he saw him. Buster Devone was counting his money. Check those two sentences. Can you detect 3 bits of flab? Try to find those words before you go on. Perhaps you found the same words I did. They are in boldface. In the moment of illumination, though, he saw him. Buster Devone was counting his money. This leaves us with a shorter version that seems stronger than the original. In the moment of illumination, he saw Buster Devone counting his money. Note how much faster that sentence seems to read than the 2-sentence version that contained the flab. And that's from a prize-winning book, the author making a slip that you will not make when you've mastered the advice in this chapter. Let's take a look at some sentences from which we want to eliminate flab. The protagonist in this story is proud of his house, where he has had meetings with important people. He is also a do-it-yourselfer. Here's the first draft of his thoughts as he comes home one day. The best scenes of my private and public life have been enacted here. Over the last 15 years, every room has been improved by my labor. What excess words would you remove? Try to find them before going on. The best scenes of my, bracket, private and public, end bracket, life have been enacted here, bracket, over the last 15 years, end bracket, every room has been improved by my labor. Note how much the pace increased after the author took out the bracketed words. The best scenes of my life have been enacted here, every room has been improved by my labor. The word life encompasses private and public. Over the last 15 years, provided unnecessary information that weakened the sentence. The next sentences come from the same novel. A successful loan shark is intent on hiring a lawyer named Bert Rivers. I went there to kind of smell out what he was like. That was the last time I was in Bert Rivers' office. From then on, Bert Rivers came to my office. What I did in revising was quite simple. I cut the entire middle sentence, which didn't add anything. The deletion strengthened what was left and stepped up the pace. I went there to kind of smell out what he was like. From then on, Bert Rivers came to my office. At chapter endings, cutting can be especially important. The following is from the point of view of a mother who has learned that her 16-year-old son has been killed in a fight. Here's the original. I looked up at the ceiling, knowing above the ceiling was the roof, and above the roof was the sky, and somewhere in the sky there was a power who knew your secrets, a power who emptied out the days and gave your kid to the maggots. What does a mother do with her love? It wasn't fair. Why did God do nothing? In revising, I thought the sentence, "What does a mother do with her love?" excessively sentimental, and why did God do nothing was too abstract to leave the reader with a suitable emotion at the end of the chapter. I cut both sentences. Here's how the chapter now ends. I looked up at the ceiling, knowing above the ceiling was the roof, and above the roof was the sky, and somewhere in the sky there was a power who knew your secrets, a power who emptied out the days and gave your kid to the maggots. It wasn't fair. The author I have spent more time editing than any other is Elia Kazan, winner of 2 Academy Awards and director of 5 Pulitzer Prize plays, who turned to fiction and became a #1 best-selling novelist. In his autobiography, Kazan said, "I was now in a new profession. My publisher, Saul Stein, was my producer, and my editor, Saul Stein, was my director. He saw quickly that I delighted in saying the same thing over and over, thereby minimizing its impact. 1 + 1 = 1/2, Saul would say. Eliminating the redundance was an important factor in his novel, The Arrangement, remaining #1 on the bestseller charts for 37 consecutive weeks. I've been teaching my strange formula, 1 + 1 = 1/2, for a long time. It has been of value even to the most talented and successful of writers. The formula gives beginners insight into one of the factors that hurts chances for publication. Catching 1 + 1s is a function of what is called line editing. Shouldn't writers rely on editors to catch things like that? The hard fact is that editors do a lot less line editing than they used to. If a novel requires a lot of line editing, it is less likely to be taken on by a publisher who has to consider the cost of editing, which is why it is incumbent upon writers to become, in effect, their own editors. This also applies to nonfiction writers and to writers of screenplays and TV dramas. On television, the program In the Heat of the Night had a glaring example of 1 + 1 when Virgil Tibbs's wife said to him, "My parents, Mom and Dad." Who else might her parents be besides Mom and Dad? The scriptwriter should have kept one or the other, not both. Most often, the 1 + 1 has the repetition put in a slightly different way. Here's an example from an American classic. "He was dirty. Everything about him was unclean. Even the whites of his eyes were soiled." What did the author fail to eliminate? Before you go on, why don't you try your hand at being his editor and bracket what you'd leave out? You could have eliminated either of the first 2 sentences. My preference would be to eliminate the second sentence because the short first sentence sets up the effective last sentence better. "He was dirty. Even the whites of his eyes were soiled." That example of 1 + 1 comes from Sherwood Anderson's classic, Winesburg, Ohio. Here's another example. "It was a dreadful situation, a time of purest humiliation." Here, the choice is clearer. The first clause is general and familiar. "It was a time of purest humiliation" is more specific. All you have to do is delete the words "a dreadful situation," and you have a more specific sentence that doesn't say the same thing twice. The following is an example of 1 + 1 from a recent book by a much admired and successful novelist. "He had time to think, time to become an old man in aspic, in sculptured soap, quaint and white." Now, let's think about that sentence. There are 2 images, an old man in aspic and an old man in sculptured soap. What's wrong? Both images convey the same thing. A person in aspic is immobilized. A person in sculptured soap is immobilized. 2 images that convey the same thing make the reader conscious of the images instead of letting the reader experience the effect. And by cutting one of the 2, the pace speeds up. If the author chose the second one, the old man in sculptured soap, he should have eliminated quaint and white. We usually think of soap as white unless a color is indicated, and quaint means odd in a pleasing way or old-fashioned. Neither definition really helps the image in this context. An old man in sculptured soap is strong. An old man in sculptured soap, quaint and white, is weaker. If the author felt he had to elaborate on sculptured soap to make the image work, perhaps he should have chosen an old man in aspic instead. Sometimes a 1+1 is created by an unnecessary repetition. I noticed the finesse with which Mr. Bretson held the creases in his trousers as he sat down. I was always fascinated by what people did to keep dress-up clothes in shape. The first-person narrator notices how Bretson holds the creases in his trousers. The narrator's generalization of what he sees is distracting. In the editing, the second sentence should come out. Earlier in this book, I have several times expressed admiration for the work of a new novelist, Nancy Kincaid, whose Crossing Blood was published in the autumn of 1992. Her effective characterization, often accomplished in a stroke, deserves high praise. But she's evidently had no training in eliminating 1+1s. In fact, here she demonstrates 1+1+1=1/3. Let's look at what she does one sentence at a time. Sometimes I wished I had run after Daddy, hugged his leg like a boa constrictor. Not bad, though perhaps the image of a boa constrictor is more negative than the author intended, as the context would seem to indicate. Sometimes I wished I had run after Daddy, stuck to him like a band-aid. A nice image. Sometimes I wish I had run after Daddy, locked myself around him like a ball on a chain, like I was the law and he was the prisoner. Fine. The only problem is that Nancy Kincaid used all three images, one after the other. The passage from her novel reads, "Sometimes I wished I had run after Daddy, hugged his leg like a boa constrictor, stuck to him like a band-aid, locked myself around him like a ball on a chain, like I was the law and he was the prisoner." Any one of the three images would be stronger than all three strung together. And the pace would, of course, quicken. The images don't reinforce each other. Once again, we break our experience to become conscious of words on paper. It's time for a word of caution. The 1+1 guideline does not apply to a conscious piling up of words for effect. Here is an example of a purposeful piling up first of verbs and then of adjectives taken from a recent nonfiction book. Their object is to tear down the individual in the eyes of the court, to deprecate, denounce, defame, condemn, and revile him, and to besmirch whatever reputation he may have had. Their intent is to leave him demoralized, disheartened, discouraged, depressed, and shaken. Clearly, this intentional piling on of verbs or adjectives is done consciously for effect, unlike the 1+1s that diminish the effect rather than add to it. In this chapter, we've learned to look closely at what we write, to test each word and phrase both for accuracy and necessity. We've also learned to eliminate most adjectives and adverbs as unnecessary flab. And we found out that even successful writers trip up and reduce the effect of their work with unnecessary repetition. Removing all forms of flab, including 1+1s, increases pace, helping a reader to feel that this book moves fast. I trust you've enjoyed improving the pace of classics and bestsellers and knowing that you won't be making the same mistakes.